Well, good afternoon, everyone. This is Brian Burke with JSA, and I've got Rocky and Wayne with us today. And to say this week was volatile would be the understatement of all understatements. Without trying to completely rehash the events of the last 5 days, and especially the last 2 days, I really want to just kind of summarize a few things. Just an incredible reversal in commodities as well as the equity market. I think we've been building to something like this, although you can never pick the day it happens and you can never really pick the day it ends either. But we've been building such a lengthy position in commodities in general. It doesn't matter whether it's corn, beans, and wheat, or if it's gold and silver, or crude oil, in particular crude oil. We've had such a run in the last quarter, or the last, you know, couple of months especially. And at the same time, we're seeing a lot of, you know, pressure in the equity markets, depending on which index you look at, down anywhere from 12 to 15% off of the highs of the late fall, early winter timeframe. And there's so many macro things at play there. You know, the inflation story, the certainly supply chain issues. We didn't talk a whole lot about COVID this week because it almost took a back seat to the other storylines, and then supply chain issues and so forth. So there's a lot of commodity specific fundamentals that were pointing in certain directions. But when you really take a macro money approach, I think the equity market felt like it was high enough, fell out of favor a little bit, and that money had to have a place to go. And the inflation story really pointed to some of that money going to commodities. And we've been doing that for a few months. Then you throw on top of it the fundamental stories of the South American drought and the risks of the Black Sea region if Russia were to invade the Ukraine. And we started adding risk premium and adding risk premium. And then that event happens on Thursday. You start to look at the market action Wednesday night into Thursday, and I really don't even care what commodity, ag commodity we're talking about. You had such incredible volume, such incredible moves higher. It became, and the equity market's moving lower at the same time. And it really felt like halfway through Thursday of this week, we saw that risk reversal trade start to happen. And I really feel like it's much more of a money flow issue than anything fundamental from that point forward as it relates to wheat in the Black Sea or corn business out of the United States or bean business shifting to the United States from Brazil due to their drought. It became a mass money flow mean reversion trade that has happened since about midday yesterday. So it is it's incredible to see a commodity like Chicago wheat hit a 50 limit high. That's at the limit yesterday. We get expanded limit 75 cents today, and we're down 75 cents. We're going to have expanded limits again on Monday for the, and there is no limits on the March, but we're going to have expanded limits for the old crop months, May, July, and Sep again. All I can say is hold on to your hats. It is going to be a volatile time. One of the questions I've been asked a lot in the last, 6 hours was the high yesterday. Is that the high? And my answer to that question is it probably is for now. The way we've reversed this thing from such an extreme high Wednesday night into Thursday's trade, it is reasonable to assume that that kind of blow off top is going to last for a bit. However, I'm not going out on a limb just yet saying that it's the high for high for old crop corn, high for old crop beans, or high for old crop wheat. I feel like there's too much in front of us by way of the calendar, acres, weather, really understanding the full South American drought production levels, really understanding the Safrina corn crop and so forth. We got way too many things still in front of us, acreage debate, all those things are still in front of us. But it is certainly possible that we've seen the highs here in the nearby as a blow off top yesterday. Specifically moving into corn, the week had a 61 cent range. We closed up 5 cents on the week after today's action going down 35. So we can certainly see a volatile ride. Pretty impressive sales for the week, a little over 1 million tons for old crop. And that was done with maybe no daily announcements. There's only been a couple daily announcements this month of February. And so that was done rather quietly, and 117,000 tons of new crop for corn. The inspections were 62.1 million bushels this past Monday's inspections report. That followed up the week prior at 57. I do want to point out those two largest inspection weeks of the year do stick out well above the weekly ranges. If you kind of turn the export program into a math problem and you say, here's the weekly needs on a seasonally adjusted basis that we need to do to hit the USDA's number, we started off the year well below that, somewhat because of Hurricane Ida. And then we've been prodding along a little bit below the goal needed for the USDA's target of exports. But these last couple of weeks have really spiked above that. I do think that type of week for the next several weeks, maybe even into May, is something we're going to see more of. Maybe not every week at 60 million bushels, but something in the 50 to 60 range is likely. As conditions have improved, water conditions have improved along the river, barge movements have been much better this last couple of weeks or week and a half. And we have a tremendous amount to move. So I do think we're going to go from looking a little bit behind the USDA as it relates to our pace to getting a little above in pretty short order by the time we get to maybe the end of March, 1st of April. I did already mention a little bit weather in South America has improved. This is maybe a bit more of a bean story, but it also affects the later crop of corn in Argentina. So getting a bit more rain in the forecast is a plus for the crop conditions down there, but it's really a question of how much damage has already been done. We already know there's a significant amount of the southern Brazil soybeans, early corn out of Argentina, early corn out of Brazil that has it's suffered greatly and it's not going to recover much, but there is a percentage of that crop that's going to benefit from these rains we're talking about, pretty heavy rains in Argentina, actually, starting at the end of this weekend and into next week. So I do think there's some fundamental storylines out here that are at least kind of a stop the bleeding approach for how much the South American weather is going to affect production. And then we can start to focus a bit more on the conditions of the Safrinha corn crop going in as it's getting planted. That northern Brazil area is actually drying out a little bit, which will aid a faster soybean harvest and planting season of that second corn. So all in all, I think week over week, you're going to have to say the weather in South America's main production regions is improving. Basis across the country, if you're not within 75 to 100 miles of the river, the Illinois River in particular, and the mid and south Mississippi rivers, your basis has been weaker. The interior markets, whether it's interior shuttles or interior ethanol plants, have all taken a step back, especially on yesterday's rally to start with. A lot of folks dropping 5 to 10 cents on basis just simply on the futures move. But it's also a reflection of the ownership that has changed hands from the producer to the end user. And whether that be a plant or a feed mill or just sold to the elevator. So there is a comfort level out there of ownership. That is not the case on the river. We continue to see strength there. We continue to see SIF firm, most recently firm because we have firmed backup barge freight. Barge freight was weaker to start the week. It's firmer to finish the week as just simply demand is increasing. A lot of bids for barges that's pulled it up here at the end of the week. But certainly a highly volatile period of time. I quite frankly don't want to see today's volatility and yesterday's volatility every day for the rest of the spring and summer. That'll age me about 20 years. But I do anticipate higher volatility than we've seen for several years to continue in the next 3 to 5 months. I just think that days like this, you know, in my almost 30-year career, days like the last two, you can probably count on one hand. So I'm not sure how many more of those I can take. But anyway, I'm going to move over to Rocky with soybeans.
Well, beans had volatility. Soybeans finished down 11 cents on the week, but $1.75 off yesterday's highs. And we were well above the 10-day and then hammered through it. And quite frankly, we only settled 15 cents off the 20-day. So making one believe that we're going to go see that thing, and I don't know what's going to happen next week. So beans down 11 on the week, meal up a little bit, 40 cents, oil up 112 ticks, but in fact, the beans were lower and products were higher, you know, crush was better, right? 25 cents better on crush. Ash on the week, you didn't see that much movement in the SIF market. Nearby is up 4 or 5 cents, but probably that's a response to barge freight, I think. But the deferred SIF market, it seems to be relatively unchanged. Maybe you could make a case that it's, you know, it's a 1 or 2 cents higher, or 1 or 2 cents lower either month. What was interesting to me is the processors. They certainly, in the West, you had 10 processors moving their bids lower, and in the East, 18 lower. Now, those all happened Wednesday and Thursday in response to the board action hire. Let's see, export sales, 1.2 million this week. We need 260,000 a week. I can remember it wasn't that long ago, and I'd be saying, hey, we need 1 million a week. We're not going to do it. Well, we're going to do it. Total commitments are 1.8 million bushels, roughly. Last year, at this time, we were 2.2 almost. So down about 383 million bushels versus last year. The USDA goal this year is 2050. Last year, we finished with 2261, so down about 211. So we've got some room to make up, but I mean, if you look at this market since November, the USDA lowered South America bean crop. This is just the USDA. That's not private. 735 million bushels. And so far, they've only increased exports 10 million bushels. So certainly it looks like we're going to meet these export sales. If you go out here and look at these deferred business, the U.S. is actually competitive in Feb-March. I don't see a ton of business getting done, but the Brazil premiums are strong. A week on week, they're probably, you know, March is probably up 5 to 15 cents. The April spot's up 40 cents, roughly, and May's up 20. And this follows 50-some-odd cent increase in basis last week. So it's hard to tell the basis improvement. Is it from a crop size of 120 million bushels? I mean, the range right now is 122 to one, little over 130. Harvest is a third done. I think agri-roll is 128.5 was the last estimate. But so the basis strength is from the crop size being worse than we think. Is it because it's wet up north? Which it has been. But one of the things we're kind of missing too is that the real's up 5% on the week, on the month, I'm sorry. So now it's 5-1. So the real strength is kind of taking away the majority of the rally on the board. And that could be the reason for the strength in basis. Regardless, the U.S. is competitive Feb, March. April, May, we're 15 cents uncompetitive. June, we're close, probably not going to do it. But July forward, the U.S. is competitive today. It'll be interesting to see how this thing plays itself out. Brazil, a third harvested. I mean, maybe they put some pressure on premiums. Maybe there's enough business done in the U.S. to bounce our premiums higher. I don't know. It'll be interesting to see how this plays itself out. Shipments, we need to average 590,000 tons a week. New crop sales, have been saying for a while that we're going to see an increase in new crop sales. I mean, they were nice today, 866,000. I mean, we're almost 5.4 million metric tons. We're not that much ahead of last year. It's about, it's right there. New crop business will continue to happen. And it's interesting to look at today, the Nov-Jan bean spread weakened here with the selling outright. Tell you what, if you get Nov-Jan even money, or if it's a penny and a half inverse, if you get that, or some kind of slight carry, given the amount of export business I expect to see this fall, boy, I think a guy needs to buy that No Jan bean spread. Let's see here. What else? Outlook meeting came out this week. 88 million acres. I mean, 51.5 yield, 4.490 production. I mean, they brought crush up to 35 million to 2.250. Exports, 2.150, only up 100. Carry out at 305. I think the point to think about is this. Those exports are going to go up. 305 carryouts, probably 150 too high, looking at what we're seeing today. So, I mean, you're looking at a 155 carryout, and that's with 88 million acres. So this is going to be really interesting to see how this thing plays it out going forward. Let's see here. I think that's it. Wayne, you're up in wheat.
Thank you, Rocky. If you look at the charts, the monthly charts, all three U.S. wheats made double tops and reversed this week. And if you also go back and look at 2011 and 12, they stayed all Chicago and Kansas City stayed anywhere from 850 to 950 until several months from now in the equivalent time, and Minneapolis stayed above $9. So I think history is a guide. We may not be looking at going back and trying to head for $10 or $12 or something like that. I'm not forecasting that, but we may have had, we may still stay relatively high until we know what's going to happen with crops and with what's going to happen in the Black Sea. If you did not see, it was, I know I chose last week to not write about the Black Sea early in the week, and so I was committed. It's a long section about how bad the hard red wheat conditions are. We still have another 6 to 10 weeks to try to reverse some of the lack of rain in the wheat, major wheat states. But if we get to the beginning of April, say April 11, back, let's say April 9 to 10, and wheat precipitation in those wheat areas is as low as it is right now, almost non-existent, and crop conditions are as low as they are on average right now, we're going to have below trend yields. And I tell you what all that means in the report. I'm going to take the rest of the time today to talk about sort of the two scenarios that might happen in the Black Sea, and what I don't know what that means, but I think it's, we've had a short discussion about it among ourselves, and I thought I would just flesh out some things because it's an unusual situation, obviously, and I think it's worth starting to think about where it leads us. And really what we're all getting, the focus of the of thinking about all this is to figure out, well, what are exports going to be? Are they not going to be available because of X, Y, and Z? Or are the crop sizes at risk too? I think that was part of what the market was trading yesterday, was would we not, if we had a war going on in a country, do they even produce a decent wheat crop? And there's no answer to that, but that's what thinking about all of these things to start in trying to understand how to think about it. And I also would like to say that I was wrong about, or I don't like to say it, but I will say it. I was wrong. I didn't think Putin would do this in Ukraine, and he obviously is committed. And so far, he's been having pretty good luck. I want to say that there are two ways to look at this, and obviously there are variations of these themes. But one of them is, well, what if he is successful in doing what he said he's going to do, which is taking over all of Ukraine? What does that mean? Well, if it's a bloodless coup is what the word I was looking for, and he just starts putting in his own government, well, that's one thing. If it turns into a guerrilla war at some point, that's another one. So those are my two opposite ends of a spectrum. And just based on what I know about the way things work in Russia, which is different from the way they work in Ukraine in many ways. I'm just going to point out some things that could happen. I circulated a video this morning or early this afternoon by a very smart U.S. Military analyst in Washington about what Putin's plan is if he does take hold of Kyiv, which he bombed heavily in the last 24 hours. So the idea is that Putin is going to come up and he's going to remove Zelensky, put in a puppet prime minister who possibly declares that Ukraine is part of Russia again. It might be an allied state, as Putin called the Donetsk area, or it could be that he just says it joins the southern district of Russia as part of our agricultural area. He could dismiss parliament and say, we don't need you. We have the Duma. So, and here's an overall statement under the Ukrainian constitution that says we're allowed to take over and we have just now taken over. Well, and he would also say at that time that Russian law applies to all commercial and governmental transactions. He also could say that the Russian central bank is taking over the Ukrainian state bank, and therefore the hryvnia becomes the ruble in Ukraine, like it was before. Do I think all of those things would occur just like that? Would they occur quickly? If so, without any opposition? No one knows the answer to that. It happened in Georgia. It happened in Chechnya, and it happened in one other place where he did something like this in the last 5 years or so. Oh, well, if that happens, what happens with the ports? In Ukraine, and as in most countries, ports are owned by the sovereign country, and they allow concessions to exporters to come in and create the ability to store grain, put it on ships, and do Panamax vessel type activities that get the export flowing. Could he say that for now they continue temporary operation so that we can get the export flowing out of Ukraine again? On the other hand, he may want to immediately try to change the legal structure of the entities that have those concessions. In Russia, the four largest exporters are all majority owned by the Russian government through the VTB, which is a wholly owned subsidiary of the Russian Central Bank that was created in 1991 to make investments in Russian Russian government ownership shares in private companies. That's the way the Russian oil and gas companies work. It's the way that these four big exporters work. And VTB has access to any capital that the Russian Central Bank needs to issue. It can issue if Putin says it can. So could that mean that the Ukraine has a government-owned export company, quote-unquote, in air quote, export company? It's called United Grain Corporation. It owns no assets and it can't originate its own grain, but it does contract with people to export small amounts of grain. The most familiar activities that it has done are to the people in China, the companies, private companies in China, not COFCO, but private companies that made investments in Ukraine in 2012 and 2013. So there's a precedent for something like that to happen. They also could fold UGC right into the Russian government-owned companies like Dmytro, RTF, and the other two. and just continue and letting those companies run the exports out of Ukraine. Doesn't mean that there won't be private exporters. In Russia, they have plenty of them. There's about 65 different exporters, many of whom obviously are much smaller than the top four. But those people also have some government ownership, and they certainly have government supervision about what they do. And in the case of rationing demand like they've had to do recently, those small companies don't get any more than anybody else's share of the company, of the total export. So if they didn't got 1% last year, that was their export quota. So they can't gain on anybody else by trying to game the system. In Russia, the central government owns the railroad system completely, and probably 80% of the rolling stock that would be used for commercial activities. In Ukraine, it's the same setup. It's owned by the central government. The rolling stock is not as new or as extensive as in Russia, but it has the ability to operate that way. What do I think would happen to companies like Cargill, Glencore, Nibulon, and ADM? It's possible that some of them, like Cargill and Glencore, already have offices operating, export origination offices operating now in Ukraine and Russia. They even have, in some cases, Russian citizens working in Ukraine, or vice versa, Ukrainian citizens working in Russia. So I think Cargill and Glencore particularly are very well connected to the central governments of both countries. I think they will get a good hearing from whatever is going to happen in Ukraine, but who knows what will happen with their ownership structure. Nibulon is the largest exporter of corn, also one of the most innovative company that owns its own barge and tugboat fleet that they build and operate on the Dnipro River. It also is run by a family which it was violently anti-communist even during the pre-Ukraine breakoff from the Soviet Union. And so that one, I think, will be a delicate one. It's an important one. They have a very large export operation in Mykolaiv. What about the oligarchs who own probably 25 to 30% of the farmland in Ukraine, and many of them operate big businesses? One of them is the largest producer of poultry, which includes operations in the EU, and has been very successful. But the guy who owns all that was the defense minister in 2014 against the Russians when they were fighting in eastern Ukraine. So do they want him around? Does he want to be around? Nobody knows. What about companies from the EU and the US who have investments in Ukraine? Many of them have, because of the low value of the hryvnia, Ukraine's currency, against the EU, there have been lots of investments made since 2014, because it's been very profitable to export basic commodities like bricks, for example, or some kind of hardware product back to the EU. How do they get treated? I don't think they'll be as high a priority as a lot of these other things I'm talking about, but it will be an issue. So I think what that means is the crops probably get processed, but some portion of the exports are delayed while all of this takes place, and it won't happen overnight. We might think it sounds easy, but if this is all going to happen, or some versions of it are going to happen, will take time. And so there could be delays in getting exports made. It's also possible that they will let existing contracts be executed. But they, in both countries, we have reports that there has been no demand in the recent week or so for new contracts to be exported out of either Russia or Ukraine. So if that sounds unbelievably heavy-handed or just impossible to imagine, that's what I thought when I sat down this morning and made the list. But what it just describes is the Russification of the Ukrainian grain production, grain handling and export business to be more like Russia. And so I think that means that there would be delays while you in exports while this all happens. The alternative, in a way, is that the guerrilla war starts out that tries to slow or end or stop Russian advancement into controlling Ukraine, because we all know, and Russia, even Putin knows, that if he gets stalled by guerrillas and the body count of Russian soldiers going back home rises rapidly, the political support for the war will drop sharply, and that could be the end of his adventure. What do I think the odds of that are? I don't have any idea either. But I think it would mean, from an export point of view, it would mean to sporadic changes, of some of which still might go on that I just mentioned, but some might not, just because of the unrest. It also could mean that there are attacks by fierce Ukrainian importance participants on ports. You know, we're not going to allow this guy to own our property and screw us. We're going to go in and destroy his ability to export. That could happen to people up in the chain of supply, and you could have Ukraine citizens having to make choices between, are you a partisan or are you a Russian fan, which could lead to more just incredible amounts of confusion about things. Does that mean that half of exports get done? It's possible. It's as good a number as anything we can come up with. But it tells you that there is some risk of that happening too. So I said yesterday that I thought one way to think about this in terms of if half of the exports didn't get done, in corn, it probably would mean that if Brazil has 112 million ton total crop, they would have about 10 to 15 million metric tons more exports than they've had, that they're having right now, because they would be returning to, you know, full production and they would be ready to go. And they're expecting, Ukraine is expecting to export 39 million tons of corn from the next crop that's to be planted soon. So 10 to 50, losing some of that to guerrilla activity, half of it's 18 million tons, 19 million tons. Could you get back 10 or 15 of that from Brazil? And does that mitigate the impact on markets? It's a possibility, I guess. Also, Ukraine is expecting to produce 20 million tons of wheat and export about half of that. I'm sorry, the exports would be 20 million tons from a 40 million ton crop. If you just look at the weather in the northern high plains, you could argue that Canada and the U.S. could have 10 to 15 million tons more spring wheat exports than they did this year. So in terms of time, most of that would not be available for export until next fall, but it's not like it's not going to be there. So if you want to think in terms of a time where there's let's say from the beginning of March to sometime in late July, where there's a lot of exports that are either a mere half or less of what they were going to be, or they're something higher than that. That's one way to think about all that. And it would be a dislocation that's important to keep. It's not like losing the entire crop. And I suppose you could argue that guerrilla warfare could lead to losing, say, 60-70% of the crop, because the guerrillas force farmers not to do what they want to do by nature. So there are those kinds of things too. And I'm sorry to be so obtuse about all this, but it's still a very, very complex situation. It looks today like the Russians have the upper hand, and they may just walk right in and avoid the guerrilla warfare. which I had been have been thinking was likely. On the other hand, the Russians may overextend themselves. The supply lines of gasoline, food, medical care, ammunition, all of those things get extended the further away you get from the Russian-Ukraine borders. So I hope that wasn't too pessimistic. I don't know the answer to it. I think I agree with what Brian said in the beginning, that we're going to continue to have a very limited knowledge of what exports are going to be. So the uncertainty will still be there, and it may change on a weekly to a monthly basis as we see how this plays out. But I thought it was worth laying out some thoughts about what could happen, just as an exercise in thinking about the unthinkable, I guess is one thing to say, one way to say it. And that's all I have for this week. And I'm glad this week has come to an end, guys.
Sounds good. Everybody have a great weekend.